Jordy Holtberg out of office. No problem. We got all kinds of great interviews from the last couple of weeks. And trust me, you want to listen into this edition of the Best of the Jordy Holtberg Show today, Monday, a Lundy Gras edition of the Jordy Holtberg Show on March the 4th, 2019.
Hall playing way out top, gets it to Norris in the left corner, steps away, now skip pass, stolen by Waters, Tremont Waters, by his lonesome, goes in, off the glass, Mays with a two-handed jam.
Bases loaded, here's the 2-2. This one hit out to right center field, will it get down? It will. Duke Ellis over to cut it off, every Tiger will advance up 90 feet. Tigers put another run on the board, it's 5-3 now.
Arden will walk right, one-on-one with Kyrie in space. Can't drive. Barrels his way to the rim, throws it up, and gets the bounce. There was no space, but he created some like a fullback and scored. 39 for Harden. 109-98 Rockets.
Some of the sounds from a busy weekend that was in the NBA, the world of college basketball, and the world of college baseball. Good afternoon and welcome to a best of edition of the Jordy Holtberg Show. We'll get you those interviews in just a little bit, but hey, we got some stuff to kind of do some business to keep up with and give you an idea of what's coming up on the show today. And of course, we've got Dennis Shaver. We'll re-air an interview with Dennis Shaver, the head coach of LSU Track and Field. And trust me, this is an interview you need to check out. Also, Mike Dettelier, some NFL draft discussion. We got to talk with him about that. A re-airing of Kevin Mawai from a while back. Trust me, that was a really good one. You aren't going to want to miss that. Definitely a good chunk of it you'll hear right here on 103.7 The Game in hour number two. Then we also got Brooks Cabina in that second hour. A re-air of that from Thursday before the NFL draft combine really got underway for a lot of the LSU players. Obviously, the biggest talking points from this week is without a doubt the fact you had Devin White just go off, have the fastest time for a linebacker in quite some time. Just some great stuff right there from Devin White. And then Greedy Williams got his time to shine earlier today and was one of the fastest cornerbacks in the draft combine. Really good numbers from both those guys. I think it's safe to say that their numbers aren't going to go down in terms of the dollar bills when it's all said and done. So congrats go out to them for putting forth a great effort over the weekend. Hopefully, you put a lot of great effort over the weekend when it comes to the Mardi Gras festivities. Hopefully, you're going to enjoy some tonight as well. That being said, though, I got to give some love to the LSU Tigers men's basketball team. Number one, they went undefeated for the first time since 80-81 on the road in conference play. That's 8-0, ladies and gentlemen. Some fantastic stuff. 24-5 on the year. And LSU got ranked number 10 in both the AP poll and the USA Today coaches poll. So congrats goes out to them. Not only that, you have Tremont Waters named a finalist for the Bob Cousy Award, which is awarded to the best point guard of that particular year. And he's one of the final five alongside Josh Perkins of Gonzaga, Marcus Howard of Marquette. You have Michigan State's Cassius Winston and Ja Morant of Murray State. So he's definitely in some elite class in terms of high-level point guards in the collegiate game, and he definitely deserves it. Hopefully he can wind up being back in the starting lineup come Wednesday when they take on the Florida Gators. And, of course, looking back at the weekend that was, LSU baseball dropped three straight against Texas, including a walk-off loss, 7-6, blowing a 6-3 lead in the final two innings of that game, the eighth and ninth inning, especially the ninth. It all got started with a very questionable hit by pitch. So it's a tough break for him this week now. He'll be getting ready for a three-game set against the California Bears. Hopefully they can bounce back, especially against Holy Cross on Wednesday. That should be a beatdown, to say the very least. That being said, though, they wound up getting dropped down in the D1 Baseball and Baseball America rankings because they were previously in the top spot. Now they're dropped down to number 10 in the baseball America top 25 poll, Meanwhile, D1 Baseball dropped them down to number 13. That is a harsh drop. They were previously ranked second, but still. That's an incredibly steep drop. And then, of course, we have Perfect Game, top 25. I think this is the biggest drop of them all. From number 1 in the poll to number 14, according to perfectgame.org. And you look at Texas. Texas moved up quite a bit in some of these rankings. In fact, they weren't ranked last week in the Perfect Game top 25. Now they're number 7. Looking at D1 Baseball, Texas, they actually didn't move up all that much. I'm trying to find them right now. Oh, no, they moved up to 12th from 22nd. So it's a decent hop, but I still say the one with Texas in perfectgame.org, that's a huge jump from 19th to number 9 in the Baseball America top 25 poll. Whichever one you want to look at, either way, you saw a lot of momentum shifting in the way of Vanderbilt being the top dog in NCAA baseball, at least as of right now. I think that's all where we're kind of leaning right now. Definitely a lot to talk about today. And hey, we got a best of edition of the Jordy Holtberg Show coming up in just a little bit. I know you're waiting feverishly to hear a lot of great interviews. Again, Dennis Shaver, Mike Tatilier, we'll have Kevin Mawai, a re-air of that, and that's always a good interview to kind of throw out right after he got inducted into, actually he got announced that he was going to be inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame. We got all that and a whole lot more. You need to listen in to the best of edition of the Jordy Holtberg Show. Clint Dumming here. I'll be here with you for the next 2 hours, replaying some great interviews and getting you through your Lundegraw, especially if you're working on this Lundegraw, make your Lundegraw just a little bit better, and hopefully you're off for Mardi Gras, because I know we are. You're listening to the best of the Jordy Holtberg Show on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com, and also the free mobile app sponsored by Visit Avery Island.
Never play cards with a guy whose last name is Estate. Don't spit into the wind. And always get your sports talk from the Jordy Holtberg Show. Live and local. 103.7 The Game.
Welcome back to the Jordy Holtberg Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com. Or should I say, the best of the Jordy Holtberg Show. And we got a lot to get to on the show today. And we're going to start things off the right way with a really cool interview that Jordy had recently with Dennis Shaver, the head coach of LSU Track and Field. This was conducted right after Antoine Duplantis set the collegiate record for the long jump in terms of indoor records. Just some fantastic stuff. You need to check out this interview right now.
Lafayette's finest, Mondo Duplantis, a collegiate record on the way to winning the pole vault at the recently completed SEC Championships at Randall Tyson Track Center in Fayetteville, Arkansas. We are thrilled to have the head coach of the LSU track and field team, the very successful Dennis Shaver, to join us today. And Dennis, thanks for the time, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jordy. Doing real good.
That's awesome. The NCAA meet is around the corner. Then the outdoor season starts. But I had to get you on to talk about Mondo, 19 feet, 5 inches. I know they do it in meters, but I like the 19 feet, 5 inches to win the pole vault. You had a front row seat for that thing. How spectacular was that?
I tell you, it was totally awesome. First of all, he's been chasing that, you know, all yep. season long when he's vaulted, and having the opportunity to do it in a championship meet with the stadium clear full was just an awesome experience to be there when it happened. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, as soon as the pole vault was over, there were several other events going on that night. But about half of the crowd left after the pole vault was over. Just goes to show you how many people showed up to watch the pole vault.
Oh, my goodness gracious. He had attempted, to your point, to try and break the record 9 times this season, 3 at the Razorback Invitational back January 26th, and he had 6 other attempts inside the Carl Maddox Fieldhouse. Did you have a premonition that this was going to be the one? And if so, how did you know?
Well, yeah, we really did. You know, I think the big part of it was for Mondo was, you know, he's a very hard worker and he's been training really hard, been experimenting with some different pole sizes in the pole vault, trying to figure out, okay, what do I need to do, you know, come championship time. And fortunately, you know, then you rest them up a little bit for those championship meets, and all of a sudden they're able to you know, elevate their performance at 1%, which is about what he did. And so it was just spectacular to see him not only win like he did, but also set that collegiate record. That record had been there for quite some time. You know, I still say, and not to put any pressure on Mondo, but he's just such a tremendous person, a great student athlete on our team. We're fortunate to have him, and I'm praying someday, and I'm sure he will. He'll break that world record in the pole vault outdoors.
Unbelievable. You were right. The record was set back in 2015. I excuse my ignorance on this, but there's got to be a starting point. So does Mondo decide what height he wants to start off at, or is that something mandated by the SEC and meet officials?
No, what they're before the meet starts, the progressions of the vault are determined based upon many factors, what it might take to qualify for NCAAs. Okay. And then it's up to each individual athlete. They can pass each height until they want to jump. And typically Mondo's going to pass until the bar gets up to about 18.4 or so, 18.6, okay. And that's when he'll come in, and that's what he did this weekend, because obviously we don't want him, and he doesn't want to take any more jumps than he has to take, you know, just to save his energy, because obviously, you know, you're running down that runway full speed and you plant that pole. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of damage takes place to the body. You don't want to do any more jumps than you have to before you're jumping at that collegiate record.
Plus, I got to believe it's a psychological thing. Oh, I'll pass on that. What? That's as high as I've ever done. What are you passing on that? Oh, man, I'm in trouble, right?
Yeah, that makes the head coach a little nervous sometimes, but you just got to believe they know what they're doing.
How heavy is the pole, and how fast is that dude running down the track?
Well, you know, Mondo, if you remember right, last year at the state outdoor championship meet, you know, he was about third or fourth in the 100 meters. Okay. For his classification at the state meet. So he's got really good speed. And as far as what the poles weigh, you're asking totally the wrong person. I wouldn't know. But I do know this, that I carried the pole bag that has several poles in it.
It's heavy.
And it was just about all I wanted to carry when we were trying to put it on the bus. But, you know, that's one of the duties of the head coach, make sure the poles get there.
Make sure the pole gets there. And it was obviously a Swedish indoor record. This is another silly question, but is it better for a pole vaulter to have more success indoors where the conditions are always right, or is outdoors, because I don't know, is outdoors better? I don't know.
You know, typically, you know, outdoors when the conditions are good, it's better outdoors, particularly when you get a little bit of a tailwind, which you don't ever have that boost indoors.
Okay.
Yeah, typically, you know, you catch a really good weather day like we typically have here in Baton Rouge in April and May. You know, we need everybody to come out and see him taking some shots at the outdoor collegiate record, too.
Tell me about the kid. I mean, this is in Acadiana, so he might be the most famous. He's got to be the most famous athlete on campus, world known. Tell me about the young man.
Well, you know, we're just blessed to have him on our team because he's, you know, number one, and I tell people this, he's really a team guy. Last year, you know, he long jumped, ran the 100, and pole vaulted at the state meet trying to help his team win the state championship. You know, he's a team guy. And Jordy, you know, the team is what's important here at LSU to the head coach, Dennis Shaver, and to our staff. So it's great to have a leader like that. And, you know, I have to say kudos to all of our jumpers, you know, and I don't want to give Mondo all the credit.
Right.
But I know when you have somebody that has that kind of energy and that kind of attitude and that kind of competitiveness, it does rub off on teammates. And our jumpers just had a superb meet at the SEC, and I know that they're going to do it at NCAAs because they've consistently been doing it all indoor season. And I think he's a big part of that happening.
You've had the Bowerman Award winner before, which is the Heisman Trophy of track and field. You've had Olympic champions, NCAA champions out the wazoo, sprinters, everything. I guess they all have the same kind of makeup, right? I mean, the competitive nature that they possess and the work ethic that they exhibit. I would imagine that's kind of similar that runs through all of them.
It sure does, and those are all the same kind of characteristics that we see on a daily basis from Mondo. You know, very confident in their ability, very much a student of their event. They not only study themselves, but they study all of those that are great before them and the ones that are great while they're being great. You know, so Mondo, I think, without any question, has those characteristics, much like many of the previous people we've had in our program, and that's the real key. Those great ones, they all have that what we call that little swagger about them,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And we know what that means. We see it in football, we see it in basketball, we see it in everything. Just somebody that, you know, that takes charge when it counts the very most, and that's what we preach here. And so it's it's just totally awesome to see them have that kind of success when it counts the very most, which is championship time, which we're in that segment of our sport, yeah, right now with the SECs and the upcoming NCAAs in about 10 days in Birmingham.
What's it like on that campus? I mean, you got both your men's and women's teams ranked in the top five. Baseball's number one. Basketball just had a huge win there. They're in the top 25. They're going to be a lock for the NCAA tournament. Football is still football. Gymnastics. I mean, what's it like on that campus?
It's just awesome. It's awesome. And I think the camaraderie, you know, that goes on throughout the athletics department has really been elevated, particularly this year. You know, all the teams are, you know, and really, you know, football obviously gets the year started for everybody. And
right,
and for football to be on that kind of a role, and Coach O and his staff working so hard, it just bleeds on to everybody else, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the men's basketball team obviously having great success. Gymnastics, you know, Coach Didi, we can't say enough great things about Coach Didi and what she does here in the department. You know, and of course, we're always trying to be in the hunt in indoor and outdoor track with both of our teams.
And
we have been, and we're fortunate. But you know what, Jordy, it's the great athletes like Mondo that's what makes that possible for us. And, you know, a guy like Mondo had a lot of different options to consider, but, you know, I think a lifelong dream of his was to represent LSU in the purple and gold. And I think that just means so much to kids like him, and that rubs off on all those others, yeah, too, about how important it is.
It's got to be a sibling rivalry. I mean, he just sets the indoor collegiate record in the pole vault, and his brother's knocking the cover off the ball for Paul Menary in baseball. How fun. I would imagine they're texting back and forth to one another.
Oh, yeah. There's a constant. They're a very competitive family. There's a lot of things going on. I know when Mondo attempted the collegiate record here in the field house a few weeks ago and he didn't get it, was the same night that his brother hit two home runs in the same baseball game for a win, and that matched his season best the previous year before. Antoine hit two in one night, you know, and now all of a sudden he's hit another one this weekend. So, there's a little bit of jabbing goes on, a little bit of smack talk goes on back and forth. So, you know, both of them are very competitive people, and what a great family. I mean, Mom and Dad both competed for us,
yeah,
here in track and field, and
yeah,
their contributions that they've made and the whole family have made to LSU is just, it's phenomenal. We're very appreciative of it.
Dennis Shaver, LSU track and field coach, getting ready for the NCAA indoor championships in Birmingham, and then I guess a few days later, the outdoor season begins, so it's no time for rest. 19-5, that's unbelievable. What's the outdoor record? Is there a bigger mark?
You know, I live in the now.
Okay.
And so I don't even know what it is outdoors.
I bet Mondo does. I bet you he knows.
Does too.
Yeah.
But I do know that he's going to be jumping at it for sure and has that opportunity, no question about it.
I'm curious, you mentioned that he had plenty of options. I can't imagine another school coming in to try and get him to go somewhere else. I don't know, but what other options? Could he have just said, I'm going pro here and now? Is that something that was in the possibilities?
He definitely would have had that option and could have taken that option. And that option's always going to be available to him, particularly as he progresses like what he's doing now. But he definitely could have signed contract and gotten sponsorship and so forth, and probably been very lucrative deal for him. But You know, like I said, you know, that's what I love about him is that, you know, he just always, you know, growing up dreamed of jumping in the purple and gold and representing LSU. And so it was never really much of a challenge, although there were other schools that recruited him.
Not sure.
But at the end of the day, you know, obviously we were hot and heavy, you know, on him from the get-go too, and encouraging him about all the things that, you know, that he could do for our team and that LSU could do for him, just like his brother. So, uh-huh. You know, it was a win-win for everybody when he decided not to go pro at that stage and enroll here at LSU and jump for our squad.
I'm kind of curious, when did, you know, you see things with football coaches offering eighth grader scholarships. When did you know that this kid was really something different?
Well, I think when he was about six. You know, and he was, for every age group since he was that young, for every age group, he has set the world record in the pole vault. So for every age group, all the way growing up. So it's pretty special. And so we had that opportunity when he was in junior high. Of course, once he got into high school, we couldn't talk to him until his junior year. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of those things, we knew he was going to be a great one. And we're lucky we have him. And, you know, maybe, who knows, outdoors, he might do more than just vault for us. I mean, you know, he's talking about maybe running on the 4x1 and like he did in high school. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, I know it's a team effort, and I don't mean to slight all your other sensational athletes. It's all about the points and the team and all. But you got a unique one here, and I just had to ask about him, and I greatly appreciate the time. And I got a funny feeling. You need to start keeping attendance figures more so than ever before, because I think you're going to set records meet in and meet out at the old Bernie Moore track and field. I think that's happening.
Well, we certainly hope so, Jordy, and it's great. I appreciate, you know, it's always great to have, you know, great athletes on your team, but when they're from Louisiana and from a family like Duplantis's, it is definitely special, and I appreciate the time on the radio, too.
You're the best. Dennis Shaver, good luck in the NCAAs, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Jordy.
Fantastic stuff as per the use. We're going to go ahead and take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll have more of the best of the Jordy Holtberg Show, including some talk with Mike Dettelia. You're listening to the Jordy Holtberg Show on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
The Blonde Bomber is back and better than ever as you are locked into the Jordy Holtberg Show on 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com, and on the app.
Welcome back to the Jordy Holtberg Show, the best of edition of the Jordy Holtberg Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. As always, live from the 237 Roof Studios. Glenn Dome kind of doing some fill-in work for you. We got all kinds of great stuff, and why not keep it going with one of my personal favorite interviews from last week, and that was with Mike Dettelia talking some Saints when it comes to the NFL draft and a whole lot more. Let's get to it right now.
Mike Dettelia, he's on Twitter at Mike Dettelia, the M&D Draft Report. If you love the draft in Nashville, this is the material you need to get so you have a good understanding of who's who and who's not. But MD, kind enough to join us. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you, Jordy.
Look, before we get to the LSU players, I'm still mind-boggled how the competition committee that's meeting in Indianapolis says that changes to the current officiating procedures seem unlikely to happen this year. Of course, we're referencing you-know-what against you-know-who, and it just doesn't seem to me that they're going to do anything about it. What are your thoughts on that?
It's no surprise to me. I mean, you know, I said this the day after, that there was no way that the NFL would make any major rule change involving this. You know, listen, I've been doing this 34 years. Yep. You don't do anything fast. Yeah. Nothing. And so what would give anybody the thought that they're going to make all these rule changes because of that one play? That's not the way the NFL works. And they would have to admit that they were wrong. And that's the other part about it. They're not going to do that. So they bring out all these old souls of the world that, you know, I've been in the sports business 50 years. This is a massive change. No, it's not. Mm-mm. If you've been in this business for more than a year, you should know. That's not how the NFL works. They are slow to react to anything at any time. We've seen this debate upon what's a catch and what's not a catch. How long has that went on, Jordy? Basically 8, 9, 10 years?
Yep.
When did they make a real definitive part in it? Last year. Did we have that discussion? No.
Yes. I got you.
But look how long. So what would give anybody the thought that it's going to change because of that one play? It's not. We would love to see it. All of us would.
If that play had happened in the Super Bowl and had decided the outcome of the Super Bowl, would that have made any snowball's difference at all?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And this is the reason why. The Monday morning, immediately after the Saints-Rams NFC Championship game, I heard Rich McKay, who is the president of the competition committee, say that there's, you know, we've debated this, went through different ways. No one's come up with a consensus on how to change it. We are all happy with the replay rule. And that we would look at an amendment, which means a small tweak of the rule. But we're not going to do anything drastic. Well, I didn't have to go any farther than that. This is the guy who runs the committee.
Yeah.
And John Elway, Stevie Jones, all of them kind of all parroted the exact same thing. You know, so this is no surprise to me at all. We would love to see something change that it wouldn't happen to someone else. You know, it wouldn't happen to another team. There's nothing you can do about the Saints game. But it doesn't happen to someone else in that same spot. But the NFL seems very secure in what they do and how they do it, and they are not going to make a change. And I think what they don't want to do is give the impression that because of that play, we changed our rules because we were wrong about it. I think somewhere down the line you will see a major an adjustment, it's not going to be this year. And look how that sentence is worded. It's basically worded for 2019.
Mm-hmm.
They're very slick about how they word that particular deal, and they bring up the human element. There's always human element involved
in
playing and coaching. Come on. Jordy, you played at a high level. You understand that there is that part in everything. But we've heard on shows that I've done, many of them, we've had former owners, we've had people that have been administrators say, you know what, if they can't get it right, why are we doing replay to begin with?
Right.
If they can't get it right, why are we doing it?
Yes.
We had the former owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Gay Culverhouse. She came on with us twice and made the comment, nothing will change. And she said, made it very clear right afterwards, they may make a little bit of an adjustment, but they will not, because their egos are so big, they are not going to admit that mistake cost the Saints a chance to go to the Super Bowl. And so she was dead right about it. She said, I've been in those meetings. They're basically, we like what we have. We're not spending any more money on technology. We're not spending any money on full-time officiating. We're not spending any money because it cost us money to extend the game. They don't like it today because of the pitch and catch part of the game. The game's now 3 hours, 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Jordy, you and I grew up in an era where they ran the ball. That clock continuously rolled.
That's right.
You didn't have 3 hour and 10 minute games.
That's right.
Those games by 2:30, they were over with in most cases. So, because they want to move to the next game, you know, because that's their money to the next game and to the next. And so, this is no shock to me at all. I wish it would be different, but it just is not.
And they certainly don't want to get to the spectrum like when LSU played Tennessee in basketball and they went to the replay 50,000 times. I mean, that's just
absurd. All right, so we'll table that discussion. But the NFL combines this weekend, and I'm kind of wondering your thoughts on how, for instance, one of the most decorated defensive players in LSU football history, the only player to win the Dick Butkus Award as the top linebacker in the country, the first player in Southeastern Conference history to be the league's defensive player of the week four times in one season. Devin White should be a pretty darn good NFL player, I would think.
Yeah, and, you know, for most, I'll say this, Jordy, you know, having grew up here and clipping beyond 50 years old, he's the greatest linebacker I've ever seen at LSU.
Okay.
And listen, I've seen some pretty good ones, from Mike Anderson to Warren Capone, Rydell Melanson. You can kind of go down the list of guys. Mm-hmm. Eric Hill was a tremendous football player. Brady James. Devin's the best. And here's the best part. He's a football puppy at linebacker. People forget. He was a running back. He was a big-time running back in high school. And I remember speaking to Devin when he came to LSU, he still had thoughts of playing linebacker. I mean, of playing running back.
Right.
They
had
to convince him to play linebacker. That was his way to get on the field quicker. Now, I took a look at there and seen Fournette and Geis and Williams. Man, you know, that's going to be a pretty tough role for me to get into. But in his mind, he really felt that was his spot. And then, you know, he gradually, you know, came into it, and he's still a puppy learning all the intricacies of playing linebacker. But look at his athleticism, his ability to get around blocks and would-be blocks, because today it's not about taking people on and beating them at the point of attack. Mm-hmm. Those days are gone. You occasionally have to do it, but really it's getting a space and getting around there. You look at his athleticism. Man, that dude can run.
Yeah.
And he can run north, south, east, west. He is a really good open field tackler. And he's gotten much better. And I've talked to Coach O about this. He's gotten much better in the pass coverage part of the game.
That's important.
Where that's such a big part of the NFL where they take you out if you can't cover on third down. But he's a three-down linebacker. He's a guy that's going to stay on the field because he can cover. He can put that big body in reverse, and he reads and he recognizes the coverages very well for a guy who doesn't have a lot of experience doing it. So, you know, he's a top 12, 13 pick in this draft. Now, a lot of that has to do with team needs. I don't give a damn about what they tell you about best player on the board. Come on, that's a bunch of malarkey.
That's
Anybody believe that? I got a skiing lodge behind my home here on the bayou. I can sell you too. They pick in the biggest need area. And so, you look at teams, you know, from that 8 to like 12, 13 mark, and they got a couple of them there that would certainly look at the linebacker position to upgrade. And Devin, you know, he had some issues in high school, really matured tremendously at LSU. He's been a model guy there. And, you know, in talking to O, you know, a lot of times just kind of BSing, you know, when he made the comment to me that, listen, I coach Ray Lewis, I had Patrick Willis at Ole Miss, he's in that same category. I was like, whoa, that's some mighty big words.
Yeah.
Because Ed doesn't really kind of go on and on about a player. That's not his deal. Now, you got to listen to how he says it sometimes because he's kind of giving you the hint without giving to you. But he didn't have to give me the hint. He came out and said he's in that category, Ray Lewis and Patrick Willis, and that's some big moccasins.
Mike Dettillier, kind enough to join us. We know he's going to be a first-round pick in all likelihood. Gritty Williams is going to be a first-round pick as well. But there's some other LSU players. Who has the – at the combine and at the pro day, who has the best chance to really improve his stock? A Foster Moreau, Nick Brissett, a John Battle, just to name a few. Who in your mind, or Cole Tracy maybe, who has a chance to really, really up their stock the most?
I think a lot of those guys are pretty much, you know, where they're going to head in the draft. But Cole Tracy is the ultimate kind of wild card here. With so many teams looking for a consistent kicker inside the 50-yard line, Cole can do it. And he's working out with Martin Anderson out in Georgia. And, you know, he's getting trained by a guy who's pretty good, at doing it.
Sure was.
And, you know, he just saw, I think the biggest worry for LSU when they started the season was he was doing it in practice. But could he translate that into a game and how he handled pressure kicks? You saw, you know, he was able to do it right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And that was impressive. We haven't seen a kicker like that at LSU in quite some time. I think he's got a chance to be the first kicker off the board. And I think the negative is going to be he doesn't kick off.
I got
you. Know, so that part about him kicking inside the 50, he can physically get a little bit stronger and maybe widen that up a little bit more. But, you know, that's where you want him to be the guy. And today, you know, Martin, he told you, man, when you were kicking in the 70s, percent range, when he was playing, he's, man, you were a top-flight kicker. Today, they get rid of you.
Yeah,
you know, they want you to kick in the 80s.
Amazing.
You know, that's the thing. And you look at Cole, he has that capacity to do so, and he handles pressure real well. And I think one of the things Martin is helping him with is getting over the kick. He said, you know, a lot of times, he said, you know, it's very similar to a golfer that makes a bad shot, maybe, you know, craps out late in the tournament.
Right.
And
right.
It affects him the next tournament, the next shot. And so, you know, his deal is always, you know, I missed a bunch of those kicks. Michael Jordan did a commercial about all the shots he missed late in the game.
Right.
It's not about the one you missed. It's about the one you kick. And it's getting him to move on because he said, you know, in this world, we are living in that kind of range where something bothers somebody of a certain age, it stays with them a while. It's hard for them to shake it off.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Mike Dottiglia, the M&D draft report. When is your draft report available for those people that crave that?
Well, we hope to have it out in the first couple of days of April. Normally we get it out around the 5th or 6th and that sort of range. So working on it now. You know, a lot of it is done. It's basically sort of editing what I have because, you know, it's like it would be like Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to edit it to the point where it's, you know, like 212 pages.
It's not Mein Kampf. I understand. I understand completely.
Yeah, and so you want to make it readable that if you've never seen that player, you want the reader to understand what you're talking about when you give the ups and downs of him and what he can get better at.
This is, fill in the blank, this is a great draft for what?
Oh, it's the best defensive tackle draft I've ever done.
Wow.
And it's 34 years for me. And so, it's really deep there, talent, depth-wise, where, you know, normally it sort of ends for defensive tackles, late second, early third. You know, the talent and the depth, and then it really winds out. This time, you're talking about you got depth into the fourth round. I mean, you got talent depth that late, and that's unusual. The other area would certainly be tight end. A lot of the juniors coming out certainly enhance that with a T.J. Hockenson from Iowa, with a Noah Fant, and a Jay Sternberger, and Irv Smith Jr. So you're talking about the best of the best, Isaac Nada from Georgia. All those guys were juniors. They came out.
Yeah.
And it's really, really helped out. And also another area that's underrated, and they don't have a Willie Rofe or a Jill Thomas in this draft class, but I think offensive tackle, because of some of the juniors that have come out, has become a pretty good area also. But so, you know, it's a meat and potato draft when you look at it. Defensive tackles, offensive tackle, tight end.
You better have them to win. Let me ask you this real quick: where the Saints are located, what's a feasible? What do they need, in your opinion, the most out of this draft?
Jordy, I think, you know, looking back and how this team has handled free agency, they have always tried to address or always have addressed their immediate needs in free agency to sort of leave some opening. Come draft time, that you have a little bit of wiggle room. They understand, you know, that best player on the board, and it's great for a sound bite, and it's great to tell, you know, the fans, everything else. But they want a little bit of wiggle room there. So I suspect the Saints in free agency will sign a veteran wide receiver. Okay. We'll sign a veteran tight end.
Okay.
And I think if they spend a lot of money, it's going to be on a veteran defensive tackle. Why wouldn't you?
Last year
at this time, you had a healthy Sheldon Rankins. You had Tyler Davidson with one more year on a contract. He's a free agent today. Who knows when Rankins is going to come back from the Achilles.
Right. That's right.
And the probable suspension of David Onyemata. All that said, what did they do right off the bat? They went after Ndamukong Suh and Muhammad Wilkerson, two defensive interior players. So if they did it last year, why wouldn't they do it this year? When you look at the situations are totally different, and so that leaves you some opening there on what to do. Would you go after a young tight end if the right one was there? Another area would be a tackle that could play guard.
Gotcha.
We all saw that once injuries started to clip this team up front, they weren't the same. And they didn't really have a legitimate guy that could play that tackle position. They had to start maneuvering. And so that comes into play. And you never have enough good cover corners.
That's right.
That's always there. So it would give you an area there of a tight end, of an offensive lineman, defensive back, of who's available. You're talking about late in round two. That's a lot of water run under the brook
by the time
you get the pick.
All right, Michael, we greatly appreciate your time. Great stuff, as always. The M&D Draft Report, look forward early April. Thank you, Michael. Have a great one, buddy.
Thank you, Jordy. Appreciate it, buddy.
Great stuff, as always, from Mike Dottiglia. I'm sure we'll talk to him a little bit down the road, closer to the NFL Draft. Going to go ahead and take a quick commercial break. Be back with more. You're listening to the best of the Jordy Holtbrink Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
There's only one place you'll find all of the movers, the shakers, and Tigers newsmakers. And it's right here on the Jordy Holtbrink Show on 103.7 The Game.
Hey, welcome back to the best of edition of the Jordy Holtbrink Show on 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com. We're going to kind of deviate a little bit from the plan here. Not necessarily a best of because we only have like a couple minutes left before we wrap up hour number one. But a quick hit of some of the more entertaining storylines, to say the least. And that is definitely going to be the city of New Orleans is definitely a part of this segment. Because in case you didn't see it, the city of New Orleans had a big parade on Sunday. And you had one of the crews, Crew d'Etat, which actually, I'd say, this is a great name in and of itself, but they showed that they are not over the NFC title game no call, which was 6 weeks ago, which I did not quite realize it was 6 weeks ago. It feels like a lot shorter of a time frame, but 6 weeks ago was when the controversial no call happened. In the city of New Orleans, they're not done being petty about it. In fact, you can check it out at 1037thegame.com right now. We have a little article about it. And the crew actually gave us a friendly reminder that they are not over it at all, with a float called Willful Blindness that has the NFL spelt out in Braille. Mind you, it's not the official Braille, but let's say close enough. It also has character of Roger Goodell and a blind ref, and everybody dressed up as a blind referee as well. So they took it to a whole nother level. And then again, that is just New Orleans as all get out. And even Cam Jordan saw the tweets and the video and said he absolutely loved it. So, hey, you've got the endorsement, the ringing endorsement of a New Orleans Saint, one of the better New Orleans Saints in Cam Jordan, the guy that they need to kind of get re-signed to a pretty decent deal, to say the least. Hour number one is history. We can't take anything back from it, but, hey, we got hour number two coming up, and it's some fantastic stuff. Kevin Mawai, Brooks Kabina, Grant Hughes, all of it coming up next. Right here on 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com. You're listening to the absolute best of the Jordy Holtbrink Show. They'll be back on a big Wednesday, Ash Wednesday. He's having a little fun during Lundi Gras. We'll be back after this.
237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette.
Have it pull off another miracle!
This is Acadiana Sports Station, 1037 The Game.
Touchdown, New Orleans!
Streaming live on the 1037 The Game mobile app and online at 1037thegame.com.
He struck him out, and the Tigers have won!
This is the Jordy Hultberg Show. Get involved and call 337-706-0111. Follow along at 1037 The Game on Facebook and Twitter. And now it's time. Here's your host, Jordy Hultberg.
Well, not quite Jordy Hultberg, but I think it's still good enough. Clint Domi kind of doing a little fill-in for him on this best-of edition of the Jordy Hultberg Show, a Lundy Girl edition of the Jordy Hultberg Show. Just some fantastic stuff live for the 237 Roof Studios. And honestly, we got a great hour of best-of interviews for you today, including Kevin Mawai. We got that coming up in just a few seconds. We'll have a re-air of Brooks Kabina and Grant Hughes. A lot of ground to cover. So let's hurry up and get to it right now with Kevin Mawai.
So tell me how this all unfolds. So everyone who's nominated meets, stays in a hotel. Take me through the process.
Yeah, so once you make the finalist list, the 15 finalists, you go to the Super Bowl city, you're in a hotel room, everybody's in the same hotel, and you have events to go do. On Thursday night, you have a gold jacket reception where you meet other Hall of Famers and sponsors of the Hall of Fame. And on Friday, you go to the Merlin Olsen Luncheon, where every gold jacket member that is in town and alive is at that luncheon. And
awesome. You
just get to see everybody. They present you there as a finalist. And then Saturday, they request that you be in a room at a given time. The vote starts, they start the process at 7 in the morning, and they go until the vote's done. And so the goal is to be done by 3 o'clock. So they ask you to be in your room by 2. And from 2 o'clock until you find out one way or another, you just sit and wait. And with whoever's in your room, it could be family or whatever. For me, it was just my wife, Tracy, and I, and that was it. And you wait for
the knock on the door.
If you get a phone call of somebody letting you know that, hey, this is the vote was on, you didn't make it next year, they give you the statistics of how, but if you get the knock, that's what you want. And I got the knock this year, and it was like a 2.5 hour wait. I found out about 4:20. It was crazy. I just, there's a moment of peace in our room where neither one of us were on the phone. We just kind of sat down, took a deep breath, and got quiet in our room for a moment. And then I got the loud boom and knock on the door, jumped out of my chair, threw my phone across the room, and it was just crazy. I looked at Tracy, and we both just started crying. And she's like, you got to go open the door.
Yeah, and look, that's the guy. David Baker is the guy. So you open the door, and can you kind of remember what he said to you?
No, he opened the door, Kevin, congratulations. You are now a Hall of Famer. So I don't even remember. I was crying so much. And everybody knows when you get the knock what it's about. So you know you made it, but it's just the emotion is so strong, especially for guys that had to wait. I waited. This is my third time around.
Yes, yes.
And, it's like, because you don't know. You don't know if you're going to get in. And the waiting for 3 hours is the worst 3 hour wait of anybody's lifetime. But to open that door is the greatest moment of my sports career in my entire life. And I'll never forget it. He's so big. I mean, I opened the door. I shook his hand, started crying, and I just hugged him. And I said, he's so big, I look like a small guy next to him. And I just cried. I cried. And then the woman, a staff member from the Pro Football Hall of Fame for the last 2 years, she was the one who came up to gather me to go to the loop, to those that didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
To go to the honor show, and she's like, I've been with you for the last 2 years. I want to be one of the first ones up here to say congratulations.
That's awesome.
I hugged her, and then I turned around, went back in my room, and Tracy and I had a moment. We both kind of cried a little bit together, loved on each other, and then within 20 minutes of all that happening, you're whisked away out of your room, downstairs, into a holding room, and that's where you find out who the other inductees are going to be. And I went down there, and the Bowling family was there, and Johnny Robinson was there and his family. Awesome. And then I went in, and then, you know, Ty Long came behind me, and then, you know, Tony and Ed Reed.
Ed Reed, right.
And so that was our class. That was our wow. class. And we're all sitting there and hugging on each other, congratulating each other. And then literally you're on a bus headed to the honor show when I present you to the nation at the NFL honor show.
So you're in the hotel room. Mr. Baker leaves. You hug your wife. Did you make one quick phone call to anyone?
Well, my kids couldn't be there. Abigail, you know, she's my 19-year-old daughter, and Kirkland, my 20-year-old son, and he's in school in Florida, and, you know, and my daughter's in school here at ASU. Well, she couldn't be there because she's training. They have a swim meet coming up, and she couldn't okay. leave because of training. And my son has just gotten back from a research trip, and school semester just started earlier in the week, and he couldn't make the turnaround that quick. And so, you know, the first person we called was my kids. We FaceTimed awesome. My daughter, and she was crying on the phone. And she, I knew I should have came. I told you to get in. You know, so I'm sorry. We're FaceTiming. We're both crying. And then I was FaceTiming my son, and he's excited. Hey, I'm so happy. You know, I knew you were going to get in this year. He's all cool about it. But and that was it. That was the first two people we called. And then they ask you not to let anybody know until the nation knows. But by the time you leave the hotel room and get down to the bus, I'm getting blown up. My, you know, text messages, people calling. The crazy thing is there's people wanting to know that would never be in my top 25 wanting to know if I got in. Like, you're going to find out, but you're not one of the people that I'm going to be the first ones to contact, you know. But, you know, the thing is everybody that knows you or that played with you or, you know, as a part of your journey, they feel invested in it, and so that it was wonderful. I mean, you know, but it was a whirlwind, and this has been nonstop. It really has been nonstop.
Kevin Mawai going into the class of the 2019 NFL Hall of Fame, one of the greatest honors he could get. You know, baseball, they get to wear a cap. To symbolize who they really want to go into the Hall of Fame as. The NFL doesn't do that. You get a gold jacket. But if you had to wear a jersey, what would you wear?
It would be a Jets jersey. This is, you know, I mean, I played there for 8 years. I had four goals there. I made a name for myself at New York. And fortunately for us, we don't have to go in with a helmet on. They go in with your face. And the Pro Football Hall of Fame recognizes the teams that you played for. And the teams recognize you. And, you know, I was drafted by Seattle, had three mediocre years there, both as a team, and I was grown as a player. But went to New York as a highly sought-after free agent, and I made a name for myself in 8 years I was there. But
yes, you did.
Then fast forward to the Tennessee Titans. I had 4 great years in Tennessee, and 2 Pro Bowls and 2, you know, all-pro years there. And I recognize myself with those too. I talked to the ownership at Tennessee Titans to thank them, and Amy Strong thanked me for what I did to represent the Titans. And I told him, like, I played for New York, and that's, you know, the stuff's going to be in green and white because that's who I really am.
Yeah.
But it would be remiss if I didn't recognize the two other teams that brought me into the league and took me out. And they deserve it. I was a part of the organization, maybe not for 8 years, but I've represented both of those teams in the best way I possibly could.
Kevin, when did you fall in love with the game of football? And I don't think anybody sets out initially and wants to be on the offensive line. When did you everybody wants to be a running back or a quarterback, but you know, when did you fall in love with the game, and when did the offensive line and the center position in particular come into play?
Yeah, nobody ever says, "Ooh, I can't wait to be an offensive lineman in in Pop Warner football." But you know, I didn't. You know, I lived in Germany. My dad was in the Army, and we lived in Germany. And when I was in eighth grade, I played flag football for the Hanau Panthers, and for my coach, who was the name of Fred Moses. And I went to practice that day, and I fell in love with it. Day one, I was 8 years old. I fell in love with football the first day I went out there, and I remember the moment, and I remember that afternoon I came back from practice, I told my mom, I'm going to play in the NFL. And, you know, that was 40 years ago. And if I remember it like it was yesterday, and at the time I played tight end, I played running back, I was a skill guy, and I played quarterback for those 2 years for that team, and then went on to play 2 years tackle. and was a quarterback and, you know, tight end. And then when I got to Leesville from Germany, we moved to Leesville. It was at the junior high, and that's where I moved to linebacker. I started growing and moved to linebacker and then played guard in junior high. And then when I got to be a freshman at Leesville High School is when I made the move to center, and I've been there ever since. And you just kind of grow into the position, but me having played those other positions younger growing up, it just added to my ability and my skill set that made me the center that I was, you know, as I got older. And but yeah, nobody ever sets out to say, "Ooh, I'm gonna be an offensive tackle." But you know, it's pretty neat because Bruce Matthews played 19 years in NFL. He's a Hall of Famer, but he played quarterback way back. And
see,
a lot of things. Villanueva, who's an offensive tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers now, he was a wide receiver in college. And what happened, you just kind of grow into the position, and that's what happened to me. And I fell in love with it because, I, you know, as a center, I had the ball in my hand every play.
Yeah, that's right.
And I got to hit every play, and that's what I enjoyed about the game.
Just such a great interview every single time you hear. I think this one is so evergreen. The NFL Hall of Famer, Kevin Mawai. You heard it here on the Jordy Holtbrink Show, and you just heard it again right here on 103.7 The Game. Going to take a quick commercial break. Be back with a whole lot more right here on the best of the Jordy Holtbrink Show on 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
Taking the hottest topics and dousing them in gasoline. It's the Jordy Holtbrink Show on Acadiana Sports Station. 103.7 The Game.
Welcome back to the best of the Jordy Holtbrink Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com. How can we not get into good mood on this Monday afternoon when talking about the NFL Combine when it comes to some of the LSU players? Is, my goodness, Devin White, Greedy Williams, it's safe to say they did not hurt their stock over the weekend. And before the NFL Combine, we got in touch with our guy Brooks Cabina of The Advocate, who was there covering it all. Trust me, you need to hear this interview. It's some good stuff.
Brooks Cabina of the Baton Rouge Advocate, who deals with all things LSU, particularly football. Brooks, thanks for the time on short notice, buddy. How are you?
I'm fine, Jordy. How about yourself, man?
I'm doing terrific. I see another offensive, quote, analyst has been added to the LSU coaching staff. Tell me about this former offensive coordinator at William & Mary. Tell me about him.
Yeah. Well, that's right. DJ Mangus was officially added to the list on offensive analysts for LSU. Yeah, he was back at William & Mary, started his career there, playing there. You might know him he played with Joe Brady, who was hired as the LSU passing game coordinator earlier this year.
Okay.
And Mangus was the offensive coordinator the past couple of years, past two seasons for William & Mary. And the connection is obviously there with Joe Brady, who was hired. And, you know, he's, if you don't know William & Mary, that's a place where a lot of coaches have come out of. There's a long historical tree that goes to guys like Mike Tomlin in the NFL. It branches very wide. There's a very, very respected group of people at William & Mary. Mangus, he's a little, he's still early in his career. And as you see with these offensive analyst positions, sometimes they're, you know, notable coaches that, you know, were either, you know, lost their jobs in recent years and then are kind of climbing back into the pool. Or you'll see young GAs, young offensive coordinators from FCS level places going to larger programs and becoming a part of their shadow staffs and kind of going along with that. So, you know, Mangus, whenever he was hired 2 years ago as William & Mary's offensive coordinator, he was the second youngest in all of Division I. So very early in his career.
Right.
And that's really kind of the summation of who he is and what LSU has just added to their staff.
Sounds good. Bruce Cabina, The Advocate, joining us. What do you think Ed Orgeron's looking for? What, you know, when the interview is taking place, what do you think he is looking for out of a, quote, analyst?
Well, you know, it's something that Orgeron's talked about a lot this past year, dating back to even last year, whenever he wanted to expand his analyst staff. We've talked it on the show before. He wants to have a wider range of people looking at film, breaking down stuff. But you know, that's been added the past couple of weeks, and it expanded last year as well. I think mainly what's going on here is Ogeron's wanted to get to the RPO offense for a long time now, and that was a main reason he added Joe Brady as a passing game coordinator. Now, with Joe Brady having a connection here with DJ, it seems like this is something where they can have more fluid conversations about what they're looking for specifically in the RPO offense. And I think DJ, from his connections with Joe Brady, that is, would have a very good relationship in what they're looking for. So that's something that's going into next season. Ogeron's talked about it recently, as recent as National Signing Day, how much they want to get to this RPO offense, what he's looked for this whole time. And this is just another addition to get to them where they can get to that level.
Bruce Cabina of the Baton Rouge Advocate, kind enough to join us. How many analysts are there on this staff now? Do you know?
There are 9 on the staff now, as far as the list is on there. That it's kind of shuffled in the past since 2018, the season ended. A couple of guys have left. You might remember a name like Kevin Coyle, who was right on the staff, and he's now a head coach with the Alliance of American Football's Atlanta Legends. So it shifted around. There's 9. It was doubled around that, just around that area last year. Who knows what exactly the full number will be by the end of it,
right,
but it's definitely a pretty large number in comparison to what LSU had before last season.
That was going to be my next question. I don't know if there's a cap on this or not, but we shall see. Meanwhile, it's a very important next couple of days for 6 former LSU Tigers who are trying to have their own job interview, speaking-wise and on the field itself at the NFL Combine. What things have you heard with this thing getting ready to kick off on Friday?
Well, actually, right now, the bench presses are going on, the workouts there. Both Nick Brissett and Cole Tracy will be doing that. The running back, Nick Brissett, and Cole Tracy, you've heard of the kicker. I'm not sure how much the bench press will go into what Cole's evaluation will do. He's also running the 40 tomorrow, so maybe that helps on kickoff, but I'm not sure what else. But, going into this, talk to a couple of NFL analysts earlier this week. One of them, NFL Network's Daniel Jeremiah. Another guy, Rick Sciarratello, he's a guy who works for the NFL Draft Bible, if you've heard of those things. Mainly, we all know that the 2 top prospects going into this week, Devin White, Greedy Williams, across the board, they're picked to be within the top 10 in a lot of places. I thought what was interesting, everybody says Devin White is that freak of nature talent that's going to be a top 10 pick. It's why he came out early. But I thought what Jeremiah said was interesting about Greedy Williams. He said he was one of the toughest, one of the 3 toughest evaluations for him in the whole draft, because he has that smooth, quick, fast athleticism. But he says that from the teams that he's talked to within the NFL, some have him high ranked in the first round and some have him kind of buried in the back, because the knock against him some are that he's a liability against the run. He's not as physical as other cornerbacks, but I mean, just the way that he played at LSU and his speed and his ability to cover, that's going to set him apart. And if he shows that this week, it looks like he'll be able to run in that 4.4, maybe even 4.3 range is what some are saying. That'll definitely set him ahead. But kind of at the on the fringe, you got guys like John Battle, safety, who Jeremiah says is kind of out on the 7th round, late round range. And Cole Tracy even may not be drafted just because of the market of kickers in the past couple of years. You guys might remember Tampa Bay Buccaneers selected a guy named Robert Aguayo from Florida State, who's just a hell of a kicker. They picked him early in the rounds, and he ended up flaming out the first in his first season at the lowest field goal percentage, and they ended up cutting him after the year. So a lot of people are kind of iffy about taking a kicker early in the round, even if not late on. But what I thought was interesting was that Foster Moreau is actually getting a lot of good looks in the NFL. Jeremiah said he was even a 4th-round guy in his mind. I mean, he loved him. He wrote Macho Man in his report about the guy just because he was throwing guys all over the tape with his run blocking, and that pass-catching ability that he didn't show much throughout his time at LSU, and that was a lot of factors that we talked about on the show due to injuries and liabilities on offense, things like that. But at the Senior Bowl, he really showed that he could catch the ball and be a receiver. And that in the NFL right now, personnel-wise, a tight end can play in the backfield as well. You see him run at fullbacks and other things. And Foster's got that size and ability to be a flexible player that is valuable across NFL offices right now. So he could be as high as fourth round in this draft, and I feel like that's something most people didn't expect whenever his career ended at LSU.
Yeah, I would think he has the most to gain out of this thing. I think his measurables would be really good. He's big. He's got size. He's got, he's got all the things. He's got length. He's got all the things you're looking for. And plus, once they do the interview with the kid, I mean, come on, he's going to be off the charts.
Right, and that's something everybody's talked about and that I've spoken with is his brightness, his leadership qualities. Those are things that people want to have in their locker rooms, especially so early in his career to jump in and have that attitude. Because early on, I mean, we've all watched NFL preseasons before and rookies come in. You're going to have these roles where you're mainly on special teams and trying to work your way in. What kind of guy are you going to have there working with the other rookies? Yeah. And that's a beneficial thing for Foster. And we talked about John Battle, too. That's something he has as well. And talking with Jeremiah about his IQ, it's the same thing. He's working under Dave Aranda has given him the ability to look at film in ways that other safeties don't. His length, 6'2", is something that might work for him. Although it sort of works against him, too, because of a lot of the drills that he does. Built for quicker guys that can move.
Right.
He's more of a 4.7 range guy in the 40, but he's worked out in Florida. If you look on the advocate.com, there's a story yesterday that I published. He's been really working on his speed, and one of the drills, he's been chasing a light. It's like a track with a light that runs up to 20 miles an hour, and he's been trying to chase that for a long time. He's got his speed down to 4.6.
Okay.
So we'll see if that's what that comes out on Monday. But certainly
Brooks,
a lot of things for those guys.
Brooks, thanks for the time, buddy. We greatly appreciate it. Continue the great work for The Advocate. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Jordy. You have a good one.
That was Brooks Cabina, our good brother, keeping it up as per the usual. Going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk with our guy. We'll re-air an interview we had with Grant Hughes from last week. Because it is some good stuff. You're listening to the best of the Jordy Holtberg Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7TheGame.com.
Never play cards with a guy whose last name is a state. Don't spit into the wind. And always get your sports talk from the Jordy Holtberg Show. Live and local, 103.7 The Game.
Here in the home stretch of the best of the Jordy Holtberg Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. And we're going to keep it going on with an interview Jordy had on Thursday with our guy Grant Hughes talking NBA. A lot's changed since the conversation, but there's still a lot relevant conversation when it comes to the playoffs. And could the Lakers miss out on it? Now it's a 90% chance, according to the four-letter network, that they miss out on it. Let you hear that interview right now.
Grant Hughes, feature writer of the NBA for Bleacher Report, and one of my favorite guests on the program when we can get him because he's a busy guy. But, Grant, good day, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. I'm with you. I'm looking forward to how a bunch of these playoff races shape up. I think we got less than 6 weeks left.
Yeah, there's about 50, 60 games in the book. They play 82, so... when you look at the big picture, where are you focusing on?
Certainly you got to, keep your eyes on the teams at the top of the conference and a team like Denver that's really a half game back of the top seed in the West now all of a sudden. But I think I'm probably most interested in, you've got four teams really fighting for the last two playoff spots in the West.
Right.
And one of them is the Lakers, which happen to have LeBron James. And so that's a big deal. So that's kind of where I'm most focused right now, just trying to parse, which of those four teams really looks like it has the best chance down the stretch to get there.
Is it beneficial for the Lakers to actually make the playoffs? If they do, they're going to be an 8 seed in all likelihood, and they got to play Golden State. So, does it really behoove them, or is it better for them to not make the playoffs?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you could definitely generally make the argument that it's better to it's worse to finish eighth and get bounced in the first round than it is to finish and get a lottery pick. But you know, it seems like the people in the know are not big on this year's draft, so you kind of throw that out. And then the whole deal of, you know, say the Lakers finish eighth, right, or even seventh, because seven and eight are tied right now, and the Lakers are three games back of both. If they get in there, I mean, the Warriors don't want to see LeBron in the first round if they had their choice. And if it's the Nuggets and it's a Lakers-Nuggets series, these Nuggets have zero playoff experience except for Paul Millsap. So I think the Lakers, you know, as much as any eighth seed really does, or seventh or whatever they end up doing, they could win a series. And that's not because I think they're a great team. It's because they have LeBron, and I'm not going to bet against them. I'm just not going to do it.
Grant, bigger disappointment, the Lakers at currently 10th in the West, or heaven forbid, the Boston Celtics 5th in the East? Who's had a more disappointing season?
I think it's probably Boston.
I agree.
At least relative to preseason expectations, you know, because I didn't think the Lakers were that great because I hated all their moves other than getting LeBron in the offseason, and they had a bunch of young guys, and so, you know, maybe I thought they'd finish fourth or something, but the Celtics were, you know, supposedly a superpower. They were super deep. They had all these young guys that were supposed to get better. Kyrie Irving was going to be healthy. Gordon Hayward's going to be healthy. And it just, you know, what have they lost? Four straight, I think. And they just rolled over against the Raptors, which just is a really bad look because, in theory, if the Celtics are going to do anything, they'll have to beat Toronto in a series at some point. So I just and maybe the most frustrating thing is it's just hard to pin down what's going on. It seems like they're not happy. It seems like they don't enjoy playing with each other.
Right.
You get these cryptic comments from Marcus Smart about guys kind of being out for themselves. And so for me, I think, you know, they're easily one of the most frustrating teams, but definitely a bigger disappointment than the Lakers.
Grant Hughes, Bleacher Report, feature writer of the NBA. In the East, there's three teams basically jockeying for one last playoff spot: Charlotte, Orlando, Miami. Golly, who's the best of those three?
Yeah, not a great bunch, right? I mean, Orlando, I thought Orlando was one of the worst teams in the league up until about a month ago. But they by far have been better than Charlotte and Miami. Orlando, I think, has won 7 of 10. And both, you know, Charlotte's lost 3 in a row. The Heat lucked out on a Dwayne Wade game winner last night, but they look really shaky. I hate to pick Orlando, but I mean, if momentum is real, they've got it. So, but really, whoever finishes eighth is going to get annihilated by the Bucks.
No question. We saw some interesting things and some interesting developments. First, Dwayne Wade hits the miracle luck shot to beat the Golden State Warriors. Where do you put Dwayne Wade in your list of all-time shooting guards in NBA history?
Well, I mean, I don't know how you weigh him or anybody against, you know, some of the, you know, past greats of the past eras. But, you know, for me, and there are a lot of, you know, there aren't a lot of people that think this, but I, you know, frankly, I like Wade better than I like Kobe Bryant.
Me too.
You've got Kobe, let's put Wade above him. Which puts him in the running for one of the best shooting guards ever, period, I think. I loved his game when he was young. He was so aggressive, and he's one of the greatest shot-blocking guards we've ever seen. And now
talk,
he's just kind of getting by on tricks, and that's fun, too.
Talk about a two-way player, right? I mean, he did it all.
Yeah, he was great, and he was the best player on a title team. You know, back before the Heat had LeBron, that title team was really all about him, even though they had Shaq at the tail end there, but he was the guy that made that team go.
And then we're watching, what a class act from Doc Rivers not too long ago with, you know, the improv'd salute to Dirk Nowitzki. Now all of a sudden, Dirk's thinking about coming back for another year? Well, has he found some lubricant to put on those squeaky knees? I mean, it's painful watching him run.
It is, and that's kind of been my thought, because he never said this is it. He's made it very clear that he's just going to kind of see how he feels, which is the approach he took last year. So all these tributes and all this stuff is so awkward to me, because, like, what happens next year if he plays again? Are we just going to pretend like this past, this farewell tour never happened? It's so funny. I hope he, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of sentimental about him. He's one of my favorites ever. And so if he wants to play again, I don't care. Give him 8 minutes a game and have him around to mentor Luka Doncic. I don't think that could, you know, that's only a good thing if he wants to just be around. But, you know, he's barely moving at all out there. It's really been that way for 2 or 3 years now.
Could you imagine Porzingis and Nowitzki and Doncic, who is 19 years old now? I mean, that's just amazing. Grant Hughes, Bleacher Report. The Pelicans looking for a GM. Danny Ferry's the interim. What odds do you give Danny Ferry of becoming the permanent?
Well, I don't know. They got to be pretty good. I think he's in an impossible position with this, you know, Davis having to play a certain amount. And but at the same time, if you're succeeding Dell Demps, it's really hard to look bad. So he's got as good a shot as anybody. I mean, you know, David Griffin is out there. He's doing TV now, and he was with the Cavs for most of their title runs with LeBron. But I don't know. It's a tough job, really, because you've still got the Benson family, you know, beholden to the Saints in a lot of ways. And it's a difficult position to be in, especially if, you know, once Davis is gone. But it's hard to say. I don't mind Danny Ferry. He had, you know, that controversial thing with the Hawks that, you know, cost him his job years ago. If that's kind of forgotten, you know, in terms of, you know, know-how and connections around the league and experience and all that stuff, you know, I believe he's from the Spurs sort of management tree.
Correct.
Too.
Correct.
There's a lot to like about him. I just don't know.
But so was Dell Demps.
Sure. Yeah. You can't always count on that, I guess.
Yeah, right. That's right. He did make a move. Have you ever heard or know anything about this guy named Darius Bertans from the Italian team Olimpia Milano? He's apparently a pretty good 3-point shooter, but what's that all about?
Yeah, that's all I know. 54% from deep. You know, his brother Davis is on the Spurs, and he's a heck of a shooter too. If he was that good, I'd be curious why he's not, you know, looking at a playoff team or teams weren't looking at him or something like that. But you never know. You know, some of these guys in the EuroLeague, that, you know, they play better when they get over to the American game because it's more wide open and all that stuff. But it'll be interesting to see. I'm just mostly curious why now and why the Pelicans.
You always make us come back down to earth in the right way, and that's good, because I agree with you. I've got that little side of me that goes, you know, when somebody makes a trade, well, if they really liked him that much, why are they getting rid of him? So anyway, I'm with you. I keep waiting for the shoe to drop on the Milwaukee Bucks, but, man, they're 47-14 as we speak. They've won 6 in a row. Are they that good?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yeah. And really, they've been that good all year. I mean, just start to finish, wire to wire, they, you know, their point differential has been the best in the league. They win close games like they did last night in overtime. They blow teams out. They're the best defense in the league. They spread the floor better than just about anybody on offense. I mean, it's, you know, you look for holes when you're talking about a potential title contender, which I think the Bucks clearly are. And it's just hard to find any. They've got a ton of depth. If you had to pick one thing to say it's a weakness, is that, you know, their second best player is probably Chris Middleton. And I don't know if that's a little bit worse than you want your second best player to
right.
be on a title team.
Right.
But the thing is, they've got like 4 or 5 guys that are about as good as Middleton. So really they have several kind of, you know, two A guys or third best type guys, which maybe that works out. I just, you know, they're just really good, and they've been really good all year. And I hope we see them in the finals. I'm most interested to watch them.
So you're saying they are not the Toronto Raptors of a year ago who stormed through the regular season, right? And then, phew, laid an egg.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? You know, you look at teams like this, and this is a criticism I have of Denver, potentially. You know, they didn't make the playoffs last year. So a lot of times a team on the upswing, you know, first-round loss, make it a couple rounds the next year, make it to the finals, win a ring. That's kind of the cliche, you know, track. The Bucks haven't quite, you know, they haven't been to a conference finals, obviously. Yeah. So maybe it's an inexperienced thing, but they're just so complete. And certainly the Raptors had a track record of laying eggs in the playoffs. The Bucks, you know, don't quite have anything hanging over them like that.
Who is the biggest competitor to Golden State in the West?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I thought about it before I came on today, and I just don't have a good answer. Tell me what you think about this. I think probably if I had to pick, it's the Rockets. And the only there are a couple. One is James Harden is just kind of unsolvable, although he has his own playoff kind of disappearances to worry about. And, you know, the Rockets should have beaten the Warriors in the conference finals last year if they don't go ice cold in game seven. And to me, like, Denver doesn't worry me. The Thunder have shooting issues, and Russell Westbrook does not concern the Warriors at all, I don't think. Okay. I think that's really clear. Okay. And then you're looking at Utah, and do you want to talk yourself into the Lakers with LeBron? Houston just seems like the team that's been there and the team that has the capacity because of Harden to just, you know, just run hot and beat anybody. So hesitantly, I think it's probably the Rockets.
But they're just a different team this year. And Chris Paul's like non-existent to me. I don't know. I don't get it. So it seems to me the most intriguing playoffs are going to be coming out of the East because, I mean, Philly's got some players. I know Boston's going south right now, but maybe, just maybe, I don't know. And Indiana, how in the heck are they where they are? How are they doing it? No Oladipo. I mean, he's got to be the coach of the year.
He's definitely in the running, Nate McMillan. You know, first of all, their defense is great. It's been top three or four all year. Miles Turner has taken a huge step on that end. And they, you know, they're a little like the Bucks in one sense in that they've got three or four guys. You know, Thaddeus Young can play. Bojan Bogdanovic is one of the most underrated wings in the league. Domantas Sabonis is going to average like 14-9 in under 30 minutes, which has never happened before. They just have a lot of, you know, good players, no great ones. But on, you know, if they finish among the top four teams in the East, with all that said, I'll be shocked. Just because, you know, Philly, Boston, Toronto, Milwaukee, the talent gap is just enormous.
All right, give me your dream scenario, Eastern Conference Finals, Western Conference Finals, and what's the best finals matchup that people are going to want to watch? Because LeBron's not going to be in it for the first time in forever. So I'm sure the NBA has a little trepidation about that. But what is your dream scenario?
I think if I get to pick in the West, obviously the Warriors, whether you want them there or not, I think they'll be there. And although I think the Rockets are, I still think they're maybe they have the best chance of beating Golden State, I'd almost rather see Denver. Just because, I mean, imagine the points scored in that series and how up and down it would be. I think still people need to see more of Nikola Jokic to appreciate how good he is. And I think in a conference finals, you get some national recognition. In the East, Milwaukee for sure. And I really want to see the Sixers get there. I think the Raptors may do it, but I want to see Joel Embiid in a conference finals playing, you know, close to 40 minutes if he can. I want to see Ben Simmons get attacked as a non-shooter in a, you know, big moments. I want to see what those guys have. And then in the finals, I want to see the top seeds. I want to see the Bucks and Warriors just because I like the idea of the two best teams in the league. You know, let's sort this out over seven games. Let's see if the dynasty continues or if maybe there's a new one.
And I think if we had asked the television networks, they'd want to see Philly and Boston in the East and Golden State and L.A. in the West. I know it's not going to happen, but that's what they would want. That's what would want. All right. This is what I think the Pelicans messed up on when they were playing the Lakers the other night. I think they should have told Anthony Davis, I want you to put on a Kobe night. I want you to shoot it every time. I want you to get 60 points. And then we can go look at the Lakers and say, okay, now what are you going to offer in the summertime? I think they missed a golden opportunity there. You know what I'm saying?
Well, anything would have been better than what we've been watching with his 5 minute stints at a time. And it's just, tell me this. I know we got to go, but what's the fan sentiment there? Nobody wants him to keep playing, right? Like, no. The fans in New Orleans are done with this, aren't they?
My solution was this. My solution was he never plays a home game ever again. And he plays 15, 20 minutes on the road if you got to do it. But he never plays at home again. It's bad. Yeah. They boo. Yeah. It's ugly. That's and the NBA should step in and do something about this because it's not helpful to anybody at all.
I was just going to say it's the rare situation where absolutely no one can be happy about this. Not Davis, not the Pelicans, not the league, not his teammates, not Alvin Gentry. It's the worst possible solution.
All right, Grant Hughes, we are coming down the stretch, and we'll see how these teams jockey for playoff position. I can't wait, man. Always great. Have a great weekend, and keep watching the hoops, my friend.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Tremendous stuff right there from my guy, Grant Hughes. Going to go ahead and take a commercial break. Wrap up the show in style next, right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
The Blonde Bomber is back and better than ever as you are locked into the Jordy Holtberg Show on 103.7 The Game, 103.7thegame.com, and on the app.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. A little wrap-up of the Jordy Holtberg Show right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com. And how can we not do it the way that he always does it? With a little On This Day in Sports History. And we'll start things off back in 1927. On this day, Babe Ruth became the highest paid player in MLB history when he signed a 3-year, $70,000 per season contract with the New York Yankees. Imagine what his contract would be now, considering how much you saw Bryce Harper get paid, $330 million. You gotta imagine Babe Ruth in 2019 probably would have gotten paid about the same range, especially in 1927. That happened on this day back in 1927 once again. Some other stuff that happened on this day, 1968. Smoking Joe Frazier TKOs Buster Mathis out in 11 rounds for the heavyweight boxing title. A legendary moment in basketball, yes, in boxing, excuse me. But talking about basketball, might as well bring up the 8th ACC men's basketball tournament. Wake Forest beats Duke on this day in 1961, 96-81. And then looking over at 1980, the 40th hat trick in Islander history by Mike Bossy happened on this day, 1980. And we also had Martina Navratilova in 1984 retained her WTA Tour Championship in New York City, beating Chris Evert 6-3, 7-5, 6-1 for her 5th overall championship title. And we're talking about Chris Evert, not Jim Everett, or as Jim Rome would call him, Chris Everett. And we also have a few birthdays to talk about in terms of famous birthdays. Philip Daniels, born on this day, 1973, former Seattle Seahawks defensive end. A couple other birthdays of note, and that includes, let's see, Draymond Green, born on this day in 1990. He's a year younger than me. Did not realize that. A couple other birthdays of note. Bobby Christina Brown, who passed away in 2015. She was born in 1993. Also, Abigail Mavity, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, American actress, born on this day, 1993 as well. Landon Donovan, American soccer player, or should I say former American soccer player, born on this day, 1982. I'm out of here. I won't say stay thirsty, my friends, because that's kind of a gimmick infringement on Jordy Holtberg, but I'll just say, Bomber to Bomber Sports, up next on 103.7 The Game.